Put the action into transaction. Don't just be next level. Be on a whole other level. Do business with Vox. Get Vox Fiber to your business starting from 2,499 Rand per month. Level up your experience with uncapped calling, hardware rental, IT solutions, and over 160 other products to enhance your business. Work smart. Level up with Vox. Visit vox.co.za to view our range. T's and C's apply.
Are you tired of selling your kidney for a laptop? Do you need to take notes in your family WhatsApp group without your boss thinking you're not working? Tired of explaining something when you could just draw it and share it? How about that backache? Is it heavy laptop related? Let the Mesa Fundi come to your rescue. Hashtag freedom with Fundi. Attach Microsoft Office for the ultimate experience. Make the shift and upgrade to the Mesa Fundi with Windows 10 Professional. The Mesa Fundi, flexibility reimagined. Available online and in store at all leading retailers. Mesa recommends Windows 10 Professional.
This is Tech Central, and I'm Duncan MacLeod. I'm chatting next to Mike Stopforth, the founder and former CEO of Cerebra. Mike, how's it?
Duncan, it's really good to chat to you, man.
Great to see you. How are you surviving the lockdown?
But it's been quite an adjustment. Hard to believe we are 8 days into this experience already, but we've adapted well, and we're keeping busy and knuckling down. I guess that's what we all have to do, right?
Yeah, absolutely. At this, how are you coping with working from home? I mean, I've actually adapted quite well to Zoom and Microsoft Teams. It's actually quite a pleasant experience. I'm actually finding it more productive than sitting in Joburg traffic to go and meet people.
Yeah, well, look, the software is not the problem in my case. Software all works really well, but like I guess any software, what I'm learning is creating spaces at home for work is quite difficult. And I personally, I find working from home quite difficult because it's quite distracting. It's too easy to walk down to the fridge or to switch on the telly or whatever it might be. But yeah, from a from a digital adaptation perspective, it's been quite revolutionary how quickly that's accelerated that experience, you know?
Yeah. Do you think we're going to fundamentally change the way we work as a result of this lockdown?
Look, you know, we tend to think that way when we're in the midst of a moment of extreme flux and change. You know, it will never be the same again. And then we very quickly get back to old habits and old behaviors.
That's true.
What I do think, though, is that this might have helped decision makers acknowledge that some of the assumptions they have made about the effectiveness of certain types of work or certain processes or certain environments might not be entirely true. So what it may do is just bring into question the effectiveness of some of those assumptions that are in play at the moment.
Yeah, I think this must particularly appeal to introverts because introverts don't necessarily like the rough and tumble of the office environment, and here they have an opportunity to squirrel away in a corner office in their homes and be as quiet as possible, which is what they enjoy. I'm one of those.
Yeah, look, I think the hermits and the hobbits amongst us are really enjoying the momentary break from the open plan office. But I do think that might be one of the things that we've realized is, you know, this movement towards very accessible, very open plan environments might not be the most conducive towards productivity. I know there's a lot of studies going on to evaluate whether or not that change was as effective as we imagined it might be. So I think, yeah, in terms of workplace design, in terms of how we structure teams and how we structure workflow, I think there will be some changes, even if they're not intentional, maybe even on a subconscious level. Mm-hmm. But I'm excited to see those. I think a lot of those will be very good for the workplace and very good for communication. I think we need some of those changes.
Mm, for sure. So, Mike, let's chat about what you've been up to. You left Cerebra at the end of 2018. That was after you sold the business to WPP, which is the big advertising agency. What have you been up to since then?
Yeah, so I mean the WPP deal ran its contractual course at the end of 2017, but I wanted to stay on at Cerebra. A, love the business. Was really enjoying the work that we were doing with clients, but it felt like there was or at the time felt like there was one or two pieces of work that I hadn't really seen to fruition, and wanted to finish those projects, and so took the extra year to, I guess, close off on one or two of those initiatives that I hadn't felt like I had given my best attention to. Once I got to the end of 2018, that I felt like the timing was good for both me and the business for a new chapter. And I did, I think, what a lot of entrepreneur founders do, and investigated or researched possible business school programs. I looked into a couple of different MBAs. I was inspired by the experiences and the stories of people like Dave Frankel, who I'd met the year before from Founder Collective in New York City. He spoke about how incredibly impactful his MBA experience had been on sort of his post-IS journey, and how many of the people that he met in that environment are still part of his business network to this day. But it was the reframing of his thinking that really intrigued me. So I looked into a couple of different programs, and I'll be honest with you,
Mike, you have probably
bent me towards those that were a little bit more efficient.
Sorry, Mike, carry on. The connection dropped there, but carry on with the thought, okay. And I'll edit it together.
No problem. So what had happened was, I looked at programs that were most efficient in terms of time and travel commitments. I did look at a lot of overseas programs, and landed up doing a course at the London School of Economics in central London, which was a wonderful experience from a kind of study and cultural exposure and exposure to new thinking experience. And I did something a little bit differently. I didn't focus on a traditional MBA program. I actually signed up for a brand new program that's been run between the London School of Economics and the Marshall Institute, which is focused on impact through entrepreneurial ventures. So what does the new breed or the hybrid breed of social enterprises look like in the world today, and how are they creating opportunities for traditional sectors, the public sector, the nonprofit sector, and the business sector to collaborate in exciting new ways? So we spoke a lot about hybrid economy solutions and a lot about impact and measuring impact. And I found that, especially in our context here in South Africa, a really interesting line of thought to pursue and to understand better.
Great. What is the Marshall Institute, by the way? I've heard the name, but I don't know them.
Yeah, Paul Marshall is a UK-based tech entrepreneur. Actually, also the guitarist from Mumford & Sons is dad. I didn't know that, but I found that out towards the end of our program. Otherwise, I might have taken advantage of that a little bit earlier on. But so he did very well in tech and has put together a research fund. Their tagline is Private Action for Public Benefit. Their research projects are focused exclusively on understanding how private businesses can have a more sustainable and more impactful role to play in economies and I think in societies at large.
So Mike, before we talk about what it is you're doing now, and you're looking at this catchphrase digital transformation, and you're consulting to big corporates, let's go back and look at Cerebra, because it was a very successful, I'm sure it still is a very successful business. When did you found it now? And maybe take us through some of the history.
Thanks, Dunks, those very kind words. The genesis of Cerebra was around 2005. I had spent a couple of years doing a number of really random, or working in a number of quite random projects and businesses, and had been hugely inspired by entrepreneurial people that I'd worked with. And like everybody, I guess, I thought, I could probably do that given the chance. And took that entrepreneurial leap and discovered very quickly that I probably couldn't do it. It was a lot harder than I expected, and I racked up a lot of debt very quickly. And then I got very lucky. I had our first client who took a real chance on us, a lady by the name of Samantha Rocky at AB InBev, now AB InBev, then Sab Miller. And that was a little internal custom blog deployment that we built for them in the days when blogs and wikis and podcasts were a very new and very exciting frontier for business. And when I say I got lucky because the very next year, the entire social web came to life, went from being this sort of lunatic fringe into becoming what would arguably be the most impactful and most disruptive piece of technology to be introduced to the world over the next 10 years. And I think even in our wildest dreams, we never imagined that Facebook and Twitter and YouTube and the like would become what they would become, not just from a business perspective, but just from a broader kind of social impact perspective. And Cerebra merged with a business called Emerging Media Communications, a gentleman by the name of Craig Rodney, a mutual friend of ours. Craig was doing a lot of traditional PR works, but focused on the tech space. A lot of his clients were asking him for more digital solutions. A lot of our clients were asking for more traditional content marketing or PR-oriented solutions. And so the meeting of the minds seemed very natural, and it seemed a really good opportunity for us. And then a couple of years later, around about 2011, 2012, started having conversations with ad networks and bigger agencies that had realized the importance of social media as part of their communication ecosystem. And we're looking to acquire those skills rather than build them from scratch. And so we went through a couple of conversations, spoke to, I guess, almost every influential ad network. It really was an exciting time. It really was a seller's market at the time. And eventually did a deal with WPP, which was, you know, hugely informative and instructive as an experience, and really edifying to us as entrepreneurs as well. It was nice to have the support of a global player like that. But the business continues to do well. I'm pleased to report, and continues to evolve as part of the broader Wunderman group, and continues to solve that same problem for clients. How do they navigate the challenges and opportunities of social media in responsible and sustainable ways? And that mandate really hasn't shifted. As much as parts of the conversation around what social media means for companies has been commoditized, certainly from an advertising perspective, the threat to reputation and to service delivery, I think, remains. And so Cerebra has always been very well placed to answer that problem. Yeah.
Does the Cerebra brand remain?
The Cerebra brand does remain. It's very much a part of the Wunderman ecosystem at the moment, and I think in time will be a much closer part of that brand. And I think they're currently consolidating a number of partner companies into the central Wunderman digital framework and positioning. Mm-hmm. So I think you'll see it more in the same terms as that. But it's always a brand that we really enjoyed and we're really grateful for.
Now, you were, you've done what many entrepreneurs would like to do, and that's build a successful business, then flip it for a decent sum of money. But, you know, there's a lot of pitfalls along the way. Maybe just take us through the actual negotiations with WPP ahead of the sale, because there are probably a lot of lessons in there for other entrepreneurs who are, you know, they've built a successful business there and they're starting to talk to potential suitors. Take us through that conversation you had with WPP. How did it happen in the first place? Did they approach you? Did you approach them? And then obviously there was some sort of due diligence that took place. Maybe take us through some of those conversations that were had and what some of the pitfalls were that other entrepreneurs who are still to go through that process might want to know about to avoid.
I see this happening so often. The conversation with a potential acquirer is always a challenging one, not just because of the number of variables involved, but because it does play to one's ego and becomes a very emotional thing quickly. So one has to do your very best to strip the facts from the feelings and to negotiate on the former rather than the latter. So the caveat to this is that at the time, I was an extremely poor negotiator. I'm now a below average negotiator. I'm working my way up to average and hope to exceed that level in future. But I was not in any way, shape, or form equipped for the scale of the negotiation. And we were working with a broker, a chap who's very well known in the industry for brokering a number of deals between potential agencies, high potential agencies, and then networks. And he was the person who really did the introduction and facilitated most of the conversation. Now, when I say we got lucky, and you know, I referred to this at the beginning, I kind of talk about it in the middle, and I talk about it at the end, because we really did. we were in a lengthy conversation with one of WPP's major competitors. There really are only five or six major ad conglomerates in the world, advertising conglomerates in the world, and a lot of the decisions about who to purchase and when to purchase targets comes down to wanting to grab market share very quickly, or wanting to grab agencies that are winning lots of awards quickly. With all due respect to the very wealthy and very influential people that run these ad networks, the decisions about who to buy are sometimes quite knee-jerk and quite emotional, and not always rooted in the best financial diligence. Having said that, that worked very well for us, because it really did become a contest between two agencies that wanted us as part of their stable. We resisted the temptation. I think this is something we look back with a lot of pride on. We resisted the temptation to play those two up against each other. We got very far down the road, an 8-month negotiation actually with initial partner. And that partner did take us through the course of a very stringent and very detailed due diligence, which you would expect. Mm-hmm. And right at the sort of cusp of doing that deal, they announced a potential global networks business by the name of Omnicom. So this was a French business by the name of Publicis, and they were going to do a big deal with Omnicom. And what that meant was a lot of the deals that were in process were suddenly put on hold. And this was really tough for us. We'd been on this emotional roller coaster, and it's suddenly been presented with another delay. And as I'm sure you'll appreciate, when you've been through that process for 8 months, it's you really want to close that deal. You really want to get past the finish line. And hearing of the delays, their competitor WPP put out some feelers, and because of the length of the negotiation, some of the statutes of limitation on our negotiating abilities or parameters had lapsed, and so the period of negotiation that was specified on our letter of intent had lapsed. So we suddenly had the opportunity to talk to their competitor, and they said, "What do you want?" And we said, "Well, do this, but a little bit better." in retrospect, I think it was the right deal. If I look at some of the deals that were done at the time under the other umbrella or other banner of the competitive conglomerate, not all of them went as well as the deals that happened under the WPP banner. And under the WPP banner, I got to work with some extraordinary people that I had respected and admired for a very long time. So there was a high level of alignment in terms of personalities and skills. So it's a very long answer to a very short question. But looking back on it now, I think there are a couple of things that I would advise entrepreneurs who are in the throes of that kind of process. Number one is know the value, the actual value of the thing you're negotiating with, right? There is an emotional value you attach to your business, and then there is an objective value to that organization. And knowing the delta between those two things, I think, is absolutely critical to having a meaningful negotiation. Number two is know all the variables in play, right? So there are multiple variables in any negotiation. Know which of those you're not going to shift on, and know which of them are negotiable, and just how many things you have to play with. Because we thought that we only had the amount of money that was being paid to play with, but there's all sorts of other things around the limitations on your restraints or your ability to hire or fire with impunity, and all sorts of other things that become very critical when you're running an organization. And then I think the third thing to realize is that, running a business on your own with no partners is extremely tough. But being a majority shareholder or a controlling shareholder in your business, or being the only shareholder in your business, while it is an enormous responsibility, also gives you absolute freedom. Mm-hmm. And the moment you negotiate on that freedom, you better be sure the amount of money you're getting paid makes that worthwhile, because you start to realize afterwards, no matter how many zeros are on the check, the freedom to not have to answer to anyone, to not have to ask permission to go on a holiday, being the master of your own time has an extraordinary multiple in terms of value attached to it. And we forget that when we're in the quagmire of the running of an organization. Mm. But you know, I very quickly learned afterwards, once you have a master, once you have somebody that you're reporting to, the value of the freedom of your own time. Mm. And to their credit, WPP gave us an enormous amount of freedom. But I think that happens when, you know, when the numbers on the spreadsheet are on the right side of the, you know, the color spectrum. So the longer it stays that way, the more freedom you have. Yeah.
I've heard a lot of startups, a lot of business owners saying they love the freedom of not working in a corporate environment because of things like the ability to go on holiday whenever you want. But most startups don't have time to go on holiday.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that sounds great in theory, right?
just thinking, I run Tech Central. I take my work with me when I go.
Exactly. I mean, I keep. It's one of the things that I find. Some of my very close family lives in Cape Town, and I spend a lot of time traveling to Cape Town to see them. And every time I come back, I get people going, "How was your holiday?" And I'm like, "That was not a holiday. That happened to be me in a different place." I instantly regret posting that on Instagram. but yes, the responsibility component, the accountability component of being an entrepreneur means that you are never off. Mm. But there is something to be said about not having to ask permission to be somewhere I always said the ultimate measure for value for me, for when I felt like I was rich, was when I could go and watch my son play cricket anytime I wanted, not when it suited somebody else, or not when I had the opportunity to fill out a form. If there was literally no meeting I could say no to, that's the ultimate moment of wealth for me. And so that doesn't really speak to a bank balance or a number of people working for you or whatever else. It speaks to the degree of freedom you create in your life through leverage or through influence or whatever it might be in those business transactions. Thankfully I had that freedom for a very long time. It's just something that you want to be sure you don't abuse or take for granted.
For sure. So, Mike, tell us, take us through what you're doing now. I know you you do public speaking. You're consulting to corporates. You're looking at this buzzword, digital transformation, which we're going to talk about in a bit more detail. But broad overview terms, what does your day consist of these days?
Yeah, so I mean, coming out of Cerebra and doing this program, I wanted to make sure that there was still a little bit of runway, on a monthly basis, so I wasn't incurring an enormous amount of debt or losing out on opportunities to create value. So I spent a lot of time going back to kind of where I was at the beginning of the Cerebra journey, which is doing a lot of public speaking, a lot of facilitation, and a lot of training work, which is essentially creating my own market, and That's been really great. There was a sense of there being some low-hanging fruit coming out of the world of Cerebra and the world of digital marketing. There are a lot of people talking about what digital transformation means, not just to the marketing or in terms of the marketing conversation, but in a broad business optimization, business resilience perspective. And I, being a bit of a contrarian and being somebody who loves to call bullshit on things that I see being created specifically with the intent of, in my opinion, stirring fear and uncertainty and creating more questions than there's worth. You know, there is that old adage that where there's mystery, there's margin. And I see a lot of that in this space. But I started a journey of going, well, what the hell do we mean by digital transformation? What is it that we're actually talking about? And is it about a set of tools that we purchase or share or include in the way that we do business that suddenly solve problems that we didn't have before? Is it the quality of the hardware that we're using in our organizations? Or is there something else going on here that is more than just a conversation that vendors and consultants are having with their clients to try and originate more opportunities for work? And I think, you know, we've arrived at a point where I think there is very clearly something called digital transformation. And I think it is very definable, but I think it is also absolutely not what most of us are talking about when we talk about digital transformation. And I started to pick this up when, at the beginning of my research, I would do a simple search for digital transformation case studies. And I could either not find any, or I could only find examples of businesses that have digitally transformed that are only 15 years old. Mm-hmm. So with all due respect to Netflix, which is one of the most celebrated, certainly by business schools and consultants, examples of digital transformation, I think it's probably easier to pivot if you're Netflix with a 3-year legacy than if you're Anglo Gold, or you are even a Vodacom, or if you're an old mutual with, you know, celebrating centuries worth of experience. But with that experience and that you know, comes this sort of legacy, this muscle memory of the way that we do things. And so I was going, where are those case studies? Where are the examples of businesses that have been around decades that have been able to adopt either the practical elements of the computing revolution, or the softer elements in terms of innovation and new ways of thinking, in order to truly adapt and evolve and progress? And any examples I could find of that had two things that seemed to be endemic to their examples. And the first one was compelling, really risk-oriented leadership that was willing to put their personal reputation, their personal wealth on the line to ensure that the organization had a chance at succeeding well into the future, well beyond their next dividend payment, right? So long-term, long vision leadership that was absolutely committed to digital transformation. And the second thing I realized was none of the successful case studies treated digital transformation as a project or an initiative or a steer code. It was a commitment, a process, an ongoing commitment to iterative improvement, kind of into perpetuity, right? So Lego, as an example, started a digital transformation project in 2004, and they've never stopped. Mm-hmm. You know, it took literally 9 years for them to get their ERP deployment right, when most of us commit to 9 months in terms of a project to see a major software overhaul succeed or affect real change in organizations. So number one is committed leadership, and number two is an ongoing process, which means that it can't be seen as something that sits outside of the core of the organization. It has to be central to the focus of the business. But if that's true, if that's what transformation looks like, and I think we can apply that to cultural transformation that happens between two businesses that merge, or even economic transformation. You know, when we talk about initiatives like BEE or whatever, if you want to get those things right, you have to have those two components as part of it. It can't be a one-off project or a let's buy something that'll solve this problem, or let's get a team onto it. And then you don't ever finish transforming. You don't like arrive at an endpoint. The clue is in the name.
Yes. I think discussions I've had around this term digital transformation, and it's particularly overused in the IT sector. And it's particularly used by vendors wanting to sell solutions quickly into
IT departments.
Yeah, yeah. Here's a solution. Here's your digital transformation. Here's the box. Unplug it. Plug it in. You're done. But even within organizations, I think it's seen as an IT project, and that's the first mistake that companies make. They give it to the IT department. They tell the CIO or the IT director, okay, we need to digitally transform. It's your project, run with it. But it's actually something that should be run from the CEO down, because it affects every element of the organization, and you have to have buy-in at the very top of the organization, because in many ways, it is actually about transforming the culture of the organization.
100%.
Yeah. And you're going to be transforming processes throughout that organization. And without that buy-in at every level from the top down, these projects are going to fail. Your views?
I sympathize with the CTO or the CIO that gets mandated with these projects or these initiatives, because it logically falls within the scope of their their influence and their job description, their portfolio. The challenge is most of these gentlemen and ladies that occupy these positions have they should be the person in the organization in charge of innovation, in charge of thinking differently about solving the problems that we have in innovative and highly efficient ways. But what has happened to a lot of those people is that they're paying for the sins of their fathers, if you like, and are their primary focus is damage control, is limiting the errors that are endemic to systems that have had millions of rands invested in them before, to in an attempt to solve business problems, right? So if you look at the ERP wash of the 90s and how much money was spent on, if we just put the right software in our business, that will solve all of the problems. The dot-com explosion of the sort of late 90s, early 2000s, all of the money that was put into getting technology to solve business problems has done either one of two things. Like number one, has either amplified the issues in those organizations. You know, so if you put technology onto an organization that has like systemic issues, that is already sick, to use the health metaphor, putting a plaster on a sick person doesn't fix the illness, doesn't change that it's a diseased person. And this is a lot of what we do. We band-aid software and we band-aid technological solutions onto organizations. And when it doesn't work, we blame it. And so the CTO and the CIO have become the damage control experts when they should be the innovation and exploration experts. And so, you know, this is one of the big, you know, if you're not an organization that can do digital transformation, and I think that's okay. Like, not everybody has to digitally transform. Not everybody has that kind of leadership and that kind of culture and that kind of commitment to an ongoing, you know, kind of iterative improvement process. There are other things you can do. There's digitization, which is an outside in, you know, adding digital layers to key customer and employee touch points to deliver hopefully a better experience and a more efficient process. The challenge with that, though, is that, again, to my earlier point, if you're putting digital solutions on top of broken business processes, it amplifies the brokenness. Yes. It doesn't solve it.
Yes.
Digital is a magnifying glass, right? So yeah. if it's a great business process, you see organizations like a Costco, which has its roots in the early 80s, very simple business model, succeeding, thriving, and even competing in arguably the most disrupted space in the world right now, which is, you know, kind of traditional retail in North America. Like, who would want to start a business in traditional retail in North America? But if you're putting really well thought out digital solutions on top of phenomenal basics, a business model that already works, all it does is amplify and accelerate that experience. Mm-hmm. But if the inherent solution, the inherent process, the DNA of that business is already dysfunctional, all you're going to do is pour paraffin on top of a spark. Mm. And this is where we see so much of this going wrong. And what happens when that happens? We point at IT and we go,
yeah,
see.
And I think it happens.
That you said would work, yeah.
And I think it happens many times in these big ERP implementations. They put SAP in, and I see it in company reports on the JSE on almost a monthly basis. There's another company that says, "Oh, earnings were down because of an ERP mess stuff up," and you know it's very often SAP that's getting blamed. But I think in many of these cases, maybe the software is to blame to some extent. But I think in many of these cases, the companies are layering the software on top, as you said, of existing problems, and it's making things worse because they're not thinking about those processes. They're not actually doing what digital transformation, if I can use that term in this context, is meant to do. And that's actually to transform the organization and its underlying processes and culture and systems. And once you've done that, then you layer the software on top of it.
Yeah. And I mean, it's easy for us to talk about, right? Because we are alluding to examples of organizations that are like unimaginably complex and huge in terms of their inertia and the amount of work that needs to be done and the amount of customers that need to be served. But my response to that is, nobody forced you to be that big. Like, nobody said you had to have that many different departments or had to diversify that much. I understand why you did that, and I understand why growth for growth's sake has always been an imperative in you know, kind of pure free market capitalism ideology. That there's no argument against that, but that was your choice. Mm-hmm. That organizational design, that scale, that level of complexity was something you created. And so when you think about how to manage unpredictability and uncertainty into the future, some of that is going to have to do with how you design that organization and how you deploy teams and how agile you are and how nomadic parts of your business are. And that's going to have as much to do with how we design offices and how we enable people and how we, as it is to do with whether we use Slack or Zoom. Mm. That's not really the discussion. You know, it's not really about which ERP solution it is. It's how complicated have we made the basics of our business in the pursuit of enormity. And again, I'm not in any way, shape, or form suggesting that you shouldn't grow your business or that you shouldn't pursue higher revenues or interesting new opportunities in market. But if you've reached a point where the scale of the organization, the size of the ship prevents it from turning efficiently, then you've got to think about building a couple of smaller ships or a number of other extended metaphors that we could pull out of that. But that's essentially, I think, is again a function of leadership and not IT.
Yeah. If I was to summarize all of this, I think you could say get the basics right before you embark on these fancy projects. Just focus on the basics. Make sure you understand the basic building blocks of your business are functioning the way they should before you try and implement a technology solution to take you into this new world.
Yeah, and I think in many ways that's what any one of these people that are custodians for these projects or custodians of large organizations would tell somebody who came to them with a startup idea. Mm. You know, get the basics right. Like, let me ask you a couple of key questions. Can you do this? Can you do that? Have you got an answer to this? But seem incapable of asking themselves the same question with the same level of clarity. And a lot of that comes down to assumptions about what has worked in the past or, you know, kind of, as Richard Mulholland would call it, legacied decisions, you know? And I think one of the very interesting things and one of the tragic things, I want to be careful that I'm not talking about this in insensitive terms, but of the pandemic that we find ourselves in at the moment is it's forcing so many organizations to think like this. Mm-hmm. Simply because, not because they haven't had threats or even immediate threats to them in the past, whether it's competitive threats or changing environment threats or macroeconomic threats or political threats or whatever it might be. It's just that the timeline of this thing is so extraordinary and so accelerated that we don't have the luxury of analyzing it or thinking about it. I don't know if you saw that meme that was going around, but I thought it was brilliantly expressed. Let me just scroll down to it here quickly. It says, who led the digital transformation of your company? A, CEO. B, CTO. C, coronavirus. Right? So we change because we have to. And so many organizations are making decisions in a 2-week time frame right now that are extraordinary. Some of those will fail dismally and others will succeed and help those businesses pivot into spaces that they never imagined possible before, certainly not in that kind of time frame. Now, I had the privilege of speaking to a friend of mine, Ryan Bacher, about this the other evening. They've been through a really interesting journey over the last time because, as I'm sure you can appreciate, flowers and gifts are not essential services in the middle of a global pandemic.
Ryan Bacher from Net Florist.
That's correct, yeah. Mm-hmm. But what they have done is pivoted in a matter of days into fresh fruit and veg. What they do phenomenally is distribute and fulfill. And partnerships that they had never imagined possible are becoming possible for the first time ever in literally hour time frames, not even week or month time frames, because of their ability to fulfill on that promise in a way that only NetFlorist can. And I look at that and I'm like, that's just extraordinary. And for an organization like that, and this is an organization of significant scale and complexity to shift, we have to be able to learn you know, he's always said to us that, you know, hope is not a strategy. He's like, hope is absolutely a strategy. All of a sudden, if you change the time frame, then but he's, I strongly recommend.
I've seen a couple of examples of this already, actually. There's a startup called Bottles that delivers alcohol online.
NAB.
And someone pointed out to me this morning that they can't sell alcohol at the moment, so they're delivering essential supplies from supermarkets.
Absolutely, yeah. Let's deliver for Pick and Pay. I mean, Pick and Pay and Woolworths can't fulfill on the demands on their online requirement right now. So why not partner in new ways? So what is phenomenal to me, Duncan, and this is a preview on an article I'm trying to write at the moment, is why do we only think like this in a time like this? Yeah. Why do we only think about this type of collaboration and this type of value creation when we have a 2-week, time frame?
Because it takes us out of our comfort zones, doesn't it? It makes us think differently, because when you're in the work mode, you're in a rut. You're not thinking outside that rut. Suddenly, you're communicating in different ways. We're talking over Zoom here. Businesses are being disrupted. Got to find ways to recover revenue. So everyone is suddenly thinking in different ways. So I think maybe a crisis could potentially, correct me if I'm wrong here, be good for the economy in the longer term, because it's going to force businesses to adapt and rethink the way they do things.
Yeah, again, I want to be cautious of being optimistic in the face of, like I said, what is a very scary situation.
But of course.
The lessons that we are learning, I think, are profound. I think from an economic perspective, I think what has been extraordinary to me and really encouraging to me is the decisiveness of our public sector and what that could mean for the way we have expectations of them and what I think ability to make decisions. What's been extraordinary is some of the public-private partnerships that have come out of this. What's been extraordinary is you've seen Discovery and Vodacom working together in a matter of days to deploy, free online consultations for potential patients. Those things, I think, when we talk about the complexity of the economy that we're in and the circumstance and the demographics of this country and the what it must mean to think of solutions that work for all 60 million South Africans, which is the level of complexity there is unbelievable. What we've learned is I think we can do it. And only because we have a common enemy. We're not so busy throwing rocks and mud at each other. We're actually throwing rocks and mud at the same thing for a change. and in doing so, I think we're learning a lot about our resilience and our ability to adapt to change. And I think that's very encouraging and possibly a promise for the future.
You make an interesting point about the government, though. I mean, the reaction by the government to this coronavirus pandemic has been, generally speaking, very good. The speed of response and some of the regulations we've seen coming out, some of the action being taken by the ministers is actually quite remarkable. I think for a political class that we assumed moved at a snail's pace. It also seems to have given a lot more power to the president. I mean, his position almost seems unassailable all of a sudden, whereas in the past, people were sniping at him. He had opponents in the ANC. The so-called radical economic transformation agenda was still lurking there in the background. Those voices have been dead silent since this pandemic started. And my hope is that, and I know we are getting a bit off topic here, but my hope is that this is going to put Ramaphosa in a much stronger position post this crisis to actually start to implement some of the reforms, structural reforms that the economy needs to get us out of the funk we've been in since the Zuma years.
Yeah. But look, I'm very outspoken and very publicly a supporter of both Ramaphosa and his constituents. And have been criticized for that in the face of what seems to be very poor performance, specifically around SOEs and some of the governance issues that he's been faced with. But I think if I take my most kind of favorable view of the chap, I think he spent the last year plus just trying to deal with factionism. And I think the only reason he's been able to be as decisive as he has been is because I think he's won that battle. And I get very excited for an ANC where he has 70-75% support. Now, I wouldn't be surprised to see us coming out of this crisis with him enjoying 80-85% support in the ANC, which eliminates, I think, and I mean, again, the caveat here is I'm not a political commentator.
Sure.
So much of the mud that he has to wade through to make decisions that are politically astute and secure in that party right now. And I think that that this can only be good for us from a political perspective. So yeah, I remain hopeful. We will only know for sure, I think, 2 weeks into lockdown, what the impact of that decision has been on infection and on testing as well. I mean, testing is obviously critical to us getting the right data. But I'm right now, thanks. I'm very proud of how we've behaved, all of us. And I think, you know, considering the voices that were dissenting and believed that we would descend into absolute chaos, and you know, we forget that we are of the country with the worst Gini coefficient worldwide, right? This thing should destroy us. It should destroy us. And I think our behavior and our decision-making has been exemplary.
Yeah, it is still early days, but let's touch wood and hope it doesn't.
Sure. So,
get to what it could get to. Indeed. Yeah. Mike, before I let you go, you've just launched a podcast, I believe, called The One-Eyed Man.
Yeah.
I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet, but tell me a bit about it.
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, the digital transformation that we work that we do, you would have picked up, focuses largely on leadership and culture. The work that I do in consulting focuses largely on leadership. Most of the conversation that you and I have had today focuses on what kind of leader, what brand of leader do we need, not only to deal with the type of crisis we're in at the moment, but into an unpredictable future, an unknown future. And so The One-Eyed Man is a podcast that recognizes that none of us really seem to have any of this figured out, but some people have some of it figured out. And so in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king, right? And my job is to speak to people who have really interesting perspectives on who have some really interesting ideas about how we lead in a time like this and into the future. And then other people that I just find really inspiring or interesting. And it's available on all major podcasting platforms. You can also find details on it on my website, mikestopforth.com/podcast. Or if you search for Mike Stopforth or The One-Eyed Man in any podcast platform, you should be able to find it there.
And finally, before I let you go, and I actually just remembered this, completely off topic to everything else we've been talking about. But I remember a couple of years ago, you licensed, if that's the correct word, your car out to Uber. Are you still doing that?
I did. So short answer, no, don't have the car in Uber anymore. Changed that plan because I moved into an estate that made it slightly more difficult for me to take as much advantage of the Uber platform as I was. But I remain a very enthusiastic user and supporter of that and other ride-sharing platforms. I think that using them has fundamentally changed my view on Johannesburg and what it's like to live and work in the city. But I've had a really interesting journey with them and respect how that organization has been able to adapt in the midst of some really trying times and some really challenging leadership issues.
Good stuff. Mike, it's always good to chat to you. It was a really good discussion. Thank you for your time. And thanks for talking to Tech Central today.
Thanks. Only a pleasure. Thanks, man. Take it easy.
All the best.
Ciao. Okay, bye-bye.